From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Bob Woodward has investigated the Watergate scandal, the Supreme Court, and the CIA. On this edition of Fresh Air, Woodward looks at the American defense establishment and how it decided to go to war with Iraq. It's the subject of Woodward's new book, The Commanders. Also today, we examine the life of Pablo Picasso with his daughter, Paloma Picasso, and his biographer, John Richardson. And TV critic David Bianculli watches some made-for-TV movies so you won't have to. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has nominated Deputy National Security Advisor Robert Gates to succeed William Webster as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Gates was nominated once before for the job of CIA chief, but withdrew his name from consideration after some lawmakers questioned his role in the Iran-Contra affair. Gates was a deputy to then-CIA director William Casey at the time when Casey gave false testimony about the Arms for Hostages operation. Today, the president defended Gates.
I know Bob Gates, and I know him to be a man of honor, and these matters have been discussed, and I have absolutely no qualms whatsoever. And this matter has been investigated over and over again. This Iran-Contra has been going on for years. And if I were worried about opening up Iran-Contra, you might suggest I wouldn't send that name forward.
Gates is a Sovietologist with vast experience in intelligence gathering and policymaking. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Relief officials in northern Iraq say that their mission may be complicated further by Kurdish refugees returning from Iran. So far, the Allied relief effort has been geared toward helping the Kurdish people who fled to the mountains along the Turkish border. That's believed to be about 440,000 people. According to U.S. military estimates, about half those people have already returned to the safe haven created by the Allies. About a million Kurds are believed to have crossed into Iran, and relief workers are worried that the aid system could be overloaded if they all attempt to return at once. Two key congressional committees defeated measures today that would have blocked what's known as fast-track authority for the president to negotiate a free trade agreement with Mexico. Despite concerns on how the new trade rules would affect U.S. jobs and the environment, Congress is close to granting the president free rein to negotiate the deal. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Supporters say the president needs the authority to keep Mexico at the table, that the talks will dissolve if Mexico thinks Congress will be able to change the deal once it's crafted. Those in Congress who don't like the idea of taking a back seat during the negotiations argue that it will be difficult procedurally and politically to amend the agreement later on. They fear that reducing trade barriers will cost jobs as U.S. factories move across the border where labor's cheap. Michigan Democrat Don Riegel.
There was a Pizza Hut opened up in Boston the other day, and they advertised about 11 minimum wage jobs, and 1,100 people showed up. I mean, people want work in this country, and by sending jobs to Mexico, we're not creating work in America.
The full House and Senate are expected to vote on fast-track authority within a week. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 38 points today to close at 2,886.85. This is NPR News. California insurance regulators have seized another major insurance company. The state took over the financially troubled First Capital Life Insurance Company, saying that the company was in hazardous condition, largely because of its vast holdings of junk bonds. First Capital's creditors are trying to put the firm's parent company into a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Last month, California regulators seized the Los Angeles-based First Executive Company in the biggest failure yet of any U.S. insurer. First Executive filed for bankruptcy today. California's insurance commissioner said he'll continue to try to rehabilitate First Capital, despite the efforts to force it into bankruptcy. Iraqi and United Nations officials may be making progress in talks on sending a U.N. police force to protect Kurds in northern Iraq. George Guetta reports.
The U.N. officials have been in Baghdad since yesterday, and the State Department said there may be a preliminary agreement on some type of guard arrangement for northern Iraq. The issue is crucial because a U.N. police force presumably could replace the more than 3,000 American troops who have joined with forces from other allied countries to set up a security zone in that area. President Bush wants the Americans withdrawn quickly, but he also wants to ensure that the Kurds do not fall victim again to attacks by Saddam Hussein's army. That's why Bush has been promoting the idea of a U.N. police force. Last week, Saddam rejected the proposal. Now he seems to be reconsidering it. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
The Commerce Department reported today that retail sales were down slightly in April, mostly in groceries, drugstore goods, and gasoline. Overall, retail sales fell by 0.1%. Analysts said the drop would have been worse if it hadn't been offset by a slight rise in auto sales. The overall decline in retail sales comes after 2 months of modest growth. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since Watergate, Bob Woodward has been one of America's best-known investigative journalists. In 1989, he began the research for a book he planned to write about the Pentagon. The book ended up investigating how America decides to go to war, focusing on the invasion of Panama and the war in the Gulf. Woodward says nearly all of the information came from interviews with people directly involved in the decisions. The key sources were administration and Pentagon officials, both civilian and military. President Bush was not interviewed. Earlier today, the president announced that his nominee for director of the CIA is Robert Gates. Gates is currently the deputy national security advisor. I asked Woodward what role Gates had played in planning the Gulf War.
Well, he was a member of what they call the Big Eight, which includes the president, vice president, Secretary of State Baker, Secretary of Defense Cheney, and Colin Powell, General Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, John Sununu, the White House chief of staff. He, in many ways, Gates acts as a co-national security advisor, along with Brent Scowcroft, who, of course, is the eighth member of this Big Eight. And somebody the president has great confidence in, apparently.
Gates had been nominated by President Reagan to be CIA director, but Gates withdrew his name because of questions regarding what he knew about the Iran-Contra affair. Do you think that there are Iran-Contra skeletons in Gates' closet?
I think there are Iran-Contra questions, as there were at the time, and that's the reason he took his name out, because he was not able to answer them or able to answer them rapidly enough. His position as the deputy CIA director to William Casey, he knew a great deal about what was going on. He has not been charged with any crime. Many senators involved in the intelligence work have questions about what he knew and when he knew it and what he did about it. And it's pretty clear from the record that he did not do a great deal about it. He just kind of said, well, keep me informed, and was not aggressive trying to get to the bottom of these so-called rumors and hints and, in fact, some direct statements that there was a diversion of funds from the Iranian arms sales to the Contras, which, of course, was illegal and something that really made the Iran-Contra affair what it was.
So you're saying that you believe that Gates knew about a lot of what was happening during Iran-Contra and allowed it to continue?
Well, in the latter stages of it, there are people who have testified from the CIA that they brought information to Gates. The record is fuzzy and ambiguous, and I think it will be most interesting to see whether there are new answers, whether there's new information, what the reaction of the Senate is to him.
What kind of CIA director do you think Robert Gates would make?
Well, he's a very smart man and knows a lot about the national security system, not only the intelligence end, but the National Security Council. He's worked as the deputy in the Bush administration. He worked in the NSC. He knows the ropes. I think he knows the kind of CIA director that Bush wants, which is somebody who's going to give intelligence information, present the facts, and not get involved in policy discussions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Woodward, and his new book is called The Commanders. Now, you started The Commanders before the war in the Gulf, even before the invasion of Panama. What were you initially looking for?
Trying to put together an account, as I had done in other books, like on the Supreme Court, The Brethren, or the book I did called Veil on the CIA, Institutional Profile, how the modern military after Vietnam functioned, how it worked, how it related to the White House and the Congress. I started this right after Bush was elected, of course, in 1989, as the Berlin Wall came down and people felt that communism was increasingly irrelevant and that it did not pose a military threat to the United States. There was some feeling the Pentagon was also irrelevant and not going to be a big deal. So in 89, I had, to a certain extent, free access to the place. No one else, to my knowledge, was doing a book on the Pentagon at that time. And then came Panama and the Gulf War. I knew the people and the procedures and how it worked, and so I was able to develop on this book and really inside, sometimes hour by hour, day by day account of how the White House and the Pentagon made the decisions to conduct these wars.
Now, I'm just curious, after the Gulf crisis started, where were you in the sense of how did you get information? Did you get it from phone calls after planning meetings happened? Were you actually allowed in on any planning meetings?
I was not allowed in on any planning meetings. I got it afterwards in interviews, discussions, from notes, documents, records. They keep lots of information in the Pentagon and the White House. And because this was really about crisis management and so much was at stake, people were willing to talk about it. People had very specific memories about what was decided and when and what was said.
When do you think Bush decided to go to war?
I think there's no single moment. One of the things I was able to uncover is that there was a top secret warning order sent by the Pentagon with Bush's authority December 29th to Schwarzkopf in Saudi Arabia, telling him in a warning order as an official message saying, be prepared to launch, in this case, the war plan, the attack on Iraqi forces in Kuwait and in Iraq. Be prepared to do this at 3 a.m. January 17th. Now, that's, in fact, when the war began. So some 18, 19 days before, in a sense, all but the final push of the button had been decided. It puts in context certain things that went on in January, certain diplomatic efforts by the administration, also the effort to get congressional support for this. I suppose if it had come out at the time that Bush was locked and ready to go to war, there would have been perhaps a very different reaction in Congress, or some members would have had different reactions saying, what are we voting on? Are we voting on an authority when the president has already decided to do it, or are we playing some role here?
You quote General Powell as saying that he was really thrown on August 5th when President Bush said, this will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait. Powell knew that that should be interpreted as interpreted that we might be sending in troops to get Iraq out of Kuwait. He had not been informed about this. He had not been consulted about this. Were there ways that Powell was shut out of the decision-making process?
Well, I wouldn't say shut out. I think, as the book shows, he's very much a player in this. But what happened is, in the first days of the crisis, it was absolutely unclear to a lot of people in the Bush inner circle that Bush was going to use the military. Some people felt it was quite possible that he would. That Sunday afternoon when he got off the helicopter on the White House lawn and said, this invasion will not stand, he declared himself, the president did, in a very forceful and almost final way. It was a surprise to Powell. And he did not know that we were making this decision, that there really had not been a systematic way of laying out the alternatives and the options and the costs. Just the day before, as the book reports, General Schwarzkopf had told the president and Cheney and Powell that it would take 8 months to 12 months to build up enough force in the Middle East to eject Iraq from Kuwait, and that would be many, many months off. It would require force levels that no one at that point had even calculated, and here you have the president saying this is essentially what we're going to do.
So Bush decided to go ahead in spite of the fact that Schwarzkopf warned him it would take a longer time than Bush was counting on to mobilize.
Well, it's not necessarily longer than Bush was counting on. It was the commander, General Schwarzkopf, saying in a very sensitive, top-secret briefing, this is how long it's going to take.
Right.
It again underscores, which I think is one of the themes of the book, that the president felt very, very committed to this and what was not going to be deterred by how long it might take.
My guest is journalist Bob Woodward. His new book, The Commanders, started out as a study of the inner workings of the Pentagon, but it ended up a study of how America goes to war, focusing on the invasion of Panama and the war in the Gulf. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Woodward, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, The Commanders. You say that your book is really about the way America decides to go to war. So I have something I want to ask you about that. Now, you report that General Powell favored letting sanctions work longer, and he thought eventually the sanctions would be effective. They might take a year or two, but eventually they would work. But he was going to make the case for sanctions, but he wasn't going to say that he really favored sanctions unless somebody else in the inner circle spoke first.
Exactly.
On behalf of sanctions. What does that say about General Powell, and what does it say about the decision-making process in terms of really encouraging a lively debate before committing to go to war?
Well, it's interesting. People have, and you have properly delineated the subtlety of what Powell was doing. It was obvious to Powell, it was obvious to everyone, and I think to the American public, that the president felt very, very strongly about this and was almost beating the tom-toms himself. And Powell felt that the alternative of economic sanctions could work, and he, as we talked about earlier, finally presented it to the president. But it was done in this way. And I think this is true of most small or large organizations. There is something called indirect communication when you come into the boss and you say, look, A will work, B will work, and then you talk at great length about B, and you speak rather passionately about it, and the boss doesn't say, is that what you're recommending? No one really asks you any serious questions about it. No one says, yeah, I think we ought to do B, but it's pretty clear, and I surmise, I can't prove, and the book sticks to the facts, I surmise Bush knew what Powell was saying here, and it didn't fly, and so Powell felt that his conscience was clear. He had presented the alternatives. Other people have looked at it and said that Powell backed off, that he really didn't lay it on the line, that he did not speak his mind fully and openly and declare himself personally. And Powell's predecessor, Admiral Crow, chairman of the Joint Chiefs for 4 years before Powell came in, felt as a matter of principle that the number one military advisor to the president had an obligation, even if it was painful, even if it was unpopular, to lay it on the line and say, this is what I feel, this is my personal conclusion, you have my advice, you can accept it or reject it, but damn it, you're going to get it.
So is this a sign to you that real lively debate wasn't encouraged? What was encouraged was to go along with the majority or to go along with the president?
Well, one of the things the book shows in, I think, perhaps intricate way, is that these people who make these decisions, the inner Bush circle, they've known each other for years. Many of them worked together back in the Ford administration in the mid-70s. They tend to think alike. They're friends. They joke. There's an informality. There is a kind of ease with which they deal with each other. As in one point, it's pointed out that Scowcroft, the national security advisor, is kind of not just a mirror to Bush on policy issues, but more or less the all-purpose playmate to the president, going fishing, golfing, joking with him, and so forth. And that this is a kind of system that a number of members of the inner circle felt was just too informal, that there was not enough rigor to it. At the same time, and again, You have to look at all of the evidence in the book. There are many times when Bush did call in and listen to people. For instance, Pat Lang, the Defense Intelligence Agency officer, who had some very strong feelings during the crisis, was brought to the White House. And in great detail, I lay out the briefing that he and other members of the intelligence community gave to the president about a week before the war started, and what they said was very grim. They said, it's going to be a tough war. The Iraqi army is tough. They will fight. It's going to last a long time. And Bush said, well, lots of people have told me differently, but he looked them in the eye and he let them have their say. So there are occasions when there was a vigorous presentation of alternative views, and there were occasions when there was not.
You report that it was General Schwarzkopf's initial plan to attack straight into Iraqi forces. Now, we all know what ended up was that end run around. But you say that it was really Cheney and Powell who recommended that end run instead of penetrating right into the forces. What does that say about Schwarzkopf's planning?
Well, as the book outlines, this again occurred in the middle of the crisis. Schwarzkopf was building up a defense of Saudi Arabia. And this, as he told Bush right from the beginning, was going to take 4 months. 2 months into it, in October, Schwarzkopf all of a sudden got an order, send somebody to Washington with a secret briefing on what you would do when you went on the offense. And Schwarzkopf was furious and said, my God, I'm only halfway through constructing this defense. More and more Iraqi forces are coming into Kuwait. It's a much more serious military problem than it was back in August. And now some SOB wants the offensive plan. He had very short time to send somebody to Washington. He sent his chief of staff, General Johnston, a Marine general, who briefed it to Cheney and Powell in the Pentagon and then took it over to Bush. They had less than 48 hours to develop the plan, and it did, in fact, show our forces going right into the strength of Iraqi forces. Army doctrine in unclassified manuals outlines that you never do that, that you always go around, that you find some indirect way, by indirections or directions found. And so it was pretty obvious to anyone who really thought about it for any period of time that we were not going to go through the middle. But, in fact, that was the plan presented to the Pentagon and the White House in October.
So you're saying Schwarzkopf presented that plan to make it clear that he had no choice but to do something that wasn't going to work, and that to do it right, he needed more time and more troops?
I think that's part of it, exactly. The point of all of this, of course, is you go back and you look at what happened, what was appearing in the newspapers and what was being broadcast was not the full story, that there was a lot of fury, a lot of anger, a lot of uncertainty, anxiety, contradictory messages, uncertainty about where we were going. It was not as smooth a process as it has been painted.
One last question. When you're researching the Pentagon and the decision makers, like in your book, The Commanders, is it usually the dissidents within the group who are willing to speak with you?
No. I try to talk to top-level, mid-level, low-level people. I try to talk to and wind up talking to people who agree with policy, people who disagree with policy, people who are making it, people who are arguing against it. In this case, in the book, for instance, there's a 60 or so page section on just the first 6 or 7 days of the crisis. And I know I interviewed hundreds of people about those meetings and discussions. And some of them were upset, some of them were delighted, some of them were neutral, and they're at all kinds of levels. And so by doing that, you have a better chance of approximating and then eventually establishing what happened.
But what about that fraternity, you know, that just doesn't want private things made public?
Well, I think the president feels that way. When my book came out, he pounded the table and was quite upset about it, and then wound up confirming that, of course, Powell made recommendation that was different, but saluted when the president decided. I obviously don't agree with that. I can understand that he tries to keep things private. I don't think, I think, if I may say this, the president overreacts to the idea that somebody who makes a recommendation and then it leaks out that he made this recommendation that, say, someone like Powell or Baker made a recommendation that was not accepted, and that's going to keep them from speaking freely at meetings in the future. I mean, they're big guys. They know that all their recommendations are not going to be accepted. They're mature people who've been in government for decades, understand the process, and I think the president has too much of an emotional reaction to the idea of, oh, my God, we're going to make X or Y look bad if we let it out. This is now history. Government's too important to just be left to the people who are in government, frankly. I think that the people in the country need or should have the opportunity to see it in action behind the scenes. That's the real measure, not the orchestrated press conferences and speeches and photo opportunities and availabilities and so forth. We're all manipulated on that. That's not real government. Real government is down in the office, 4 or 6 or 20 people sitting around the table saying, what the hell are we going to do about this? And in a sense, that is the measure of leadership, pro and con, much, much better than looking at somebody give a speech or handle a press conference.
Bob Woodward, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Bob Woodward's new book is called The Commanders. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Richardson's biography of Pablo Picasso has been hailed as the best work yet about one of the century's greatest artists. Coming up, we talk with Richardson and with Picasso's daughter, Paloma Picasso. And TV critic David Bianculli examines this week's harvest of the seemingly endless crop of bad TV movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker has arrived in Israel on the last leg of his fourth Middle Eastern shuttle mission. Baker has met three Palestinian leaders, and tomorrow we'll see Israeli officials. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Secretary Baker got his first up-close look at the Israeli-occupied West Bank today. Instead of flying in from Amman, Jordan, as he had planned, Baker came overland, passing Jewish settlements and Palestinian towns and villages. Baker said the drive gave him a better sense of how short the distances are and therefore how important it was to promote peace. He then met a delegation of three Palestinian leaders headed by East Jerusalemite Faisal Husseini. After the three-hour meeting, Husseini told reporters that he would consult with the PLO leadership in Tunis. He also said the Palestinians had already shown a lot of flexibility and called on the Israeli public to pressure their government to make peace. Tomorrow, Baker meets Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir and will try to narrow the gap between Israel and Syria. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
More than 40 people have been killed and around 400 others injured in a two-train accident in western Japan. Officials said that most of the some 500 passengers in one of those trains were traveling to a World Pottery Festival. While the cause of the crash is still unknown, local officials said that a failure in a signaling device might be responsible. The trains were to have passed each other less than 2 miles from the site of the crash. Relief workers in northern Iraq say that a second tent city built for Iraqi refugees is now filled. Thousands of refugees are streaming down the mountains every day, seeking shelter in the camps. NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
It's clear that the Allied effort to get the refugees down from the mountains is working. It took only 3 days to fill the second of the camps, which houses more than 18,000 people. There are now close to 45,000 camped in the wheat fields outside of Zaho. The American military is about to begin construction on a third tent city there, but their efforts are being hampered by a shortage of tents and other construction materials. Refugees are now returning to the valley at a rate of about 5,000 a day. They've set up makeshift shelters all around the two tent cities. More than half of the refugees come from the city of Duhok, which is outside of the Allied security zone. Until the refugees are convinced the city is safe to return to, the overcrowding situation in the valley is likely to worsen. I'm Deborah Wong reporting.
The government says that retail sales dipped 0.1% last month, while car and truck sales climbed 0.3%. But much of that climb was apparently in used car sales. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 37 points to close at 2,886.85 on volume of some 207 million shares. This is NPR News. In South Africa, a judge has sentenced Winnie Mandela to 6 years in prison for her conviction on kidnapping and assault charges. Mrs. Mandela was released on $70 bail while her attorney applies for permission to appeal, a process that could take months. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela says that the sentence given his wife will not jeopardize his power-sharing talks with South African President F.W. de Klerk. The White House has confirmed that it is working on a Middle Eastern arms control plan, while a group of lawmakers in Capitol Hill unveil their own proposal to curb the arms race in the region. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Bush wouldn't give any details of the White House arms control plan, but he did say the U.S. was engaged in consultations on the issue with the allies in the region. According to newspaper reports, the White House plan for Middle East arms control would prohibit Israel from developing any more nuclear arms. It would require all the nations in the region to give up chemical weapons, and it would ban ballistic missiles with a range of more than 90 miles. The White House plan focuses on the users of weapons in the region. Meanwhile, a group of lawmakers has unveiled a plan that would focus on the suppliers. The congressional proposal would require the White House to work with the other big sellers of arms to the Middle East, the Soviet Union, France, Britain, and China, to develop a plan to curb conventional and unconventional weapons. If the administration failed to make a good-faith effort to develop such a plan, then Congress would terminate all U.S. arms sales to the Middle East. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Gasoline prices have moved up again. According to the AAA, the average price of self-service regular gasoline jumped close to 2 cents in the last week to $1.16 a gallon. The association says that average gasoline prices have increased 9 out of the last 10 weeks. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There have been hundreds of books about Pablo Picasso, but Time magazine art critic Robert Hughes says there's been no really satisfactory biography until now. Previous biographies written in English tended to be useful but over-adoring or deplorably ignorant. My guests are the author of this new biography, John Richardson, and Picasso's daughter, Paloma Picasso. Richardson was a friend of Pablo Picasso. They met in 1953 when Richardson shared a house with one of the artist's close friends. Richardson says Picasso's life was in turmoil at the time because his mistress, Francoise Gillot, had just left him. Gillot is Paloma's mother. Paloma is now a designer and businesswoman with her own line of scarves, handbags, cosmetics, and perfume. Richardson is a former vice president of Knoedler Galleries and the former head of American operations for Christie's Auction House. His new book is the first in a 4-volume biography of Picasso. Volume 1 covers the first 25 years of the artist's life. With so many biographies of Picasso already published, I asked Richardson why he thought another one was necessary.
I found that too many accounts were being written by people who didn't know him, who didn't know the facts, who were distorting things, who were fictionalizing or psychoanalyzing or historicizing or politicizing his life without any respect for the man or his work or the facts of his life.
Paloma Picasso, is there something that you learned from this book that helped you understand your father?
I'm not sure that I discovered him as a person because actually he was not such a mysterious person. I mean, he was very open. So even though you do, I mean, of course, I learned a lot of new facts that I never knew. I think that by knowing him, and I think that's why it's so interesting that John knew him, he was just who he was. He was never pretending to be somebody else than who he was. And that's why I think it's very sad that some people try to portray him as this very, you know, fiendish kind of a person. I think that his flaws were very obvious, but his qualities were many more.
You were his friend. Now you're his biographer. I'm wondering if there are any personality traits that bugged you as a friend that you've forgiven him as an artist and that you understand more now as his biographer. Maybe you could illustrate that with a story.
There are no traits. None of his traits bothered me at all. It seemed to me that he was extraordinarily forbearing, that he needed people around him. He needed to. He was gregarious because he needed to feed off his friends in a way. And when I knew him at any rate, there were a lot of people around, and he was very patient with them. He was very giving. He was very. I can't think of a single trait that I found in any way unpleasing. I think it must have been very different for his wife or mistress or children or people who were extremely close to him, because life with a genius is never easy. But to my mind, I mean, absolutely no complaints of any kind.
When you say he would feed off his friends, what do you mean?
I mean that he... If you spend a day with Picasso, I said this to somebody recently, that he would show you his recent work. You would go off and have lunch with him in a restaurant in Cannes or wherever it was. You'd come back. You might be asked to stay on for dinner, and you'd have a marvelous time. He would be the most generous and host, generous with his time and his attention. But at the end of the day, the group of people would suffer from collective nervous exhaustion. He'd taken their energy, And with it, at the age of whatever it was, 78, 80, he would stride off into his studio and work all night on your energy.
Well, what does that mean, that he would take your energy?
It meant that, in some curious way, he would get a an emotional response out of people. He would use different methods with different people. I mean, the love, passion for his work, whatever it was, he'd get whatever it was, and he would somehow use this. All his life, he'd done this. Particularly, of course, he got this out of his wives or his mistresses, but also out of his friends. It was very important to get this sort of tremendous surge of affection, of love of his work, of understanding, whatever it was. And this was something that fueled his furnace.
Paloma Picasso, did you experience that too?
Well, I think, you know, being his daughter, I would see him on a more, you know, day-to-day basis when I was with him, which was not all the time, because from the time that I was 4 years old, I started living in Paris with my mother and would spend the holidays with him, which meant all the same, it meant 4 months out of the year, when actually, you know, you're not at school, so you do spend a lot more time with your parents at that time. And certainly I would with my father, because I did spend, you know, many, many hours just sitting next to him while he was working. And actually more of in a mute understanding than with a lot of talking. And he was giving in that way too. You know, I don't think you need to spend hours with your children telling them what to do and what not to do. I mean, you can give them just that much by just, you know, being there next to them. And it was a very intense relationship. Everything about him was intense, and he created intense emotions in people. Again, I'm sure that it is much easier to be his daughter than to be his wife or mistress, whatever it was. He didn't really demand things from you, which he might have done in a relationship. He kind of provokes things in you and accept whatever you were ready to give him. He was also a lot of fun to be with.
You've both pointed out that he was much more difficult from the perspective of his wives and mistresses. Paloma Picasso, your mother, Françoise Gillot, wrote a memoir about life with Picasso that made him seem very, very difficult to live with. Did you...
I think any relationship is extremely difficult. I mean, think of your private life. You'll find lots of details that actually may seem very extraordinary if they were printed in a book.
Well, I mean, one of the things that John Richardson, even you point out in the first volume of your biography of Picasso is that his first wife, Fernande, he used to lock her up in the studio when he'd go out on an errand so that she wouldn't be able to go out. Paloma Picasso, I wonder if there were ever things that you didn't forgive him for about the way he treated your mother or other women in his life, as a woman yourself.
No, I never in my life entered in that consideration. I always believe, you know, I'm his daughter. I'm not to judge either other relationship. I mean, what's important to me is my relationship with him. I think I can't be responsible for my mother or my father in the way they dealt with each other. And actually, they also, somehow, neither of them have ever made me feel that way either, which I think is the best gift that they ever gave me. I never heard my father complain about my mother or my mother complain about my father. And I guess that's also what's given me stability. Even though we had kind of two houses, you know, one with my father and one with my mother, they were two different worlds. They were not opposed world because they were two, you know, artistic environments, and they were not antagonistic. Yet they were to me, you know, two different worlds, and I'd never put them in competition.
My guests are Paloma Picasso, the daughter of Pablo Picasso, and John Richardson, the author of a new biography of the artist. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are John Richardson, the author of a new biography of Pablo Picasso, and Paloma Picasso, the daughter of the artist. A previous recent biography of Picasso by Ariana Stassinopoulos really dwelled on Picasso's misogyny. And I wonder how you both reacted to that biography. And if, John Richardson, if that's one of the things you felt you were correcting.
Well, it didn't seem really worth correcting. Uh-huh. I mean, it just seemed to me it was written by somebody who knew nothing about art, knew nothing about Picasso, had it in for him. It was written from a sort of bogus feminist point of view. It was very inaccurate, and it had absolutely no understanding. It was sort of gossip column stuff, that wasn't one of the ones I was even bothering to correct. No, I think I was only one little reference to her in a note, but no, there were slightly more serious biographies which did need, which occasionally erred, and which I did try to correct.
Yet in your chapter about Gertrude Stein, about his, Picasso's relationship with Gertrude Stein, you call him a lifelong misogynist.
Well, I think that he was. I think any Andalusian was born a misogynist.
I think that's right.
It's born into them. I mean, charisma, machismo is an Andalusian word. It's an Andalusian phrase, and it involves a misogyny. And for better or worse, he was a misogynist, but it didn't stop him being incredibly tender with women, enormously loving of women, and women very loving of him.
John Richardson, you write that that Picasso, as a young man, told a student friend of his that in art one must kill one's father. And you say that this Oedipal maxim lies at the heart of Picasso's creative process. Can you explain?
Well, I think that the character of Picasso's father, was something that is very crucial in Picasso's life. Well, in all our lives, I suppose our father plays an important part. But, I mean, the fact that Picasso's father was an extremely poor painter, a very bourgeois man. I mean, I remember Picasso once saying to me about his father, "Il était bourgeois, bourgeois, bourgeois." And I think that at the same time, his father wanted to direct his life, wanted to turn him into a painter religious subjects or historical subjects, whatever it was, Jean painter, an art teacher like himself. And therefore, the father had to be, in a manner of speaking, destroyed. He had to get rid of his father in order to become himself. And I think this was an important process in his sort of emergence from this sort of chrysalis of academic training and paternal solicitude. And I think that this was, in the nature of things, it was a natural process that he had to, as it were, kill his father. I don't mean that he had to take a knife and stab him, but that he had to demolish his authority over him.
Paloma Picasso, did you ever go through a phase like that yourself, of feeling that to have your own identity, have your own name in the world, that you had to, you know, on a psychological level, kill your father?
Somehow I don't think so, because he was... it's actually strange that I never sort of went through this period. I had to, you know, I wanted, when I first started working, to actually just be Paloma and not Paloma Picasso. And the Picasso would always end up appearing everywhere. So I had to one day, you know, accept the fact that I would always be Paloma Picasso. And I could see that, you know, the further I went into the desert, I would always find somebody who'd say, "Oh, look, this is Paloma Picasso, this is Pablo Picasso's daughter." And coming to the realization of that, I just, you know, decided that there could be a life being Picasso's daughter, and that I had to kind of find out who I was and not really worry about what other people thought. And actually, which is something that he told me himself when I was about 7 or 8 years old, I started to draw a little better. So I thought I would copy things. So I'd copy, you know, the Picassos in the house, Matisse, some comic strip that I had. And very proudly, I went to show my father. And so when he looked at them, instead of congratulating me, as I thought he would do, he told me, you know, to just rely on myself, to not, you know, be afraid to be my own person, and that I didn't need to copy anybody, that I should just do, you know, what I had in me and try to be proud of myself on my own.
It sounds like you're both pretty close, that you've known each other for years.
We've known each other for years.
Yeah.
I love Paloma. She's always been a very good friend.
Some people would say that that's not a good relationship for a biographer to have
with
the daughter of the subject. No, no, really, because the closer you are to the family, the more protective you feel, less distance that you have.
But I think that I'm not protective of my father. I think he can, you know, even though he's not, you know, with us anymore, I think he can defend himself quite easily. So I don't think that anybody needs to defend my father. And when I talk to John, I think we have a very, you know, we have a real relationship as friends, you know, whether actually, you know, he was a friend of my father or not. I mean, it's not the issue. We actually get along.
And I think we see Picasso in a similar light.
Mm-hmm.
And compared to one or two other painters of his generation, Picasso was, was a much warmer, nicer human being. I don't know why he's got tarred recently with this sort of misogynistic brush. He really, he was not nearly as inhuman in certain ways as one or two other painters.
Like who?
Well, I don't want to. I mean, Matisse wasn't nearly as warm and attractive a human being as Picasso.
The thing is, he became, you know, such a star. And because he's such a star, apart from being this, you know, fabulous painter, his life is being scrutinized. And other painters, you know, of the 20th century, whose life was maybe actually, as you say, I mean, they were much more extravagant. You know, some other people had much more extravagant lives. The fact that we were always in the news, at least starting in the 50s, I mean, made everything seem like a big circus. But really, I mean, it's not, you know, it's, of course, I mean, not everybody becomes a noun by the time that she's 3 weeks old, like I did. But I mean, also, after all, he didn't have he didn't have such a strange life. I mean, things, you know, nobody, I mean, I think most people's life, if looked at it, you know, so closely, will appear to be extreme.
I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Richardson is the author of A Life of Picasso, Volume 1, 1881 to 1906. Paloma Picasso is a designer and the daughter of Pablo Picasso and François Gillot. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, President Bush announced today his choice for new CIA director. It's Robert Gates. What do you have on that?
Well, Nina Totenberg is covering that nomination for us. And, of course, it's especially interesting because Gates' nomination was withdrawn during the Reagan administration because of his implication in the Iran-Contra scandal. So this suggests not only President Bush's confidence about Gates' background, but it probably also suggests that he's not worried by all the talk of a renewed investigation of the October surprise theory. Also tonight, we'll have a special report by Brenda Wilson on AIDS. She follows a black woman in New York who has AIDS. It's the leading cause of death among young black women.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When it comes to the wide array of programming offered on TV these days, TV critic David Bianculli generally feels the more the merrier. Generally, but not always.
One of the things I really do believe about TV is that it's better now than it was in the 50s, 60s, or even 70s. Partly because the programming has gotten more sophisticated, and partly because there's so much more of it to go around. 20 years ago, there were no cable networks, PBS was just getting started, and independent stations were little more than places to go for old reruns and older movies. Today, the new programming comes from everywhere, and some of the series on cable TV, PBS, independent stations, and the Fox network are as good as anything shown on the big three networks, and sometimes better. Stuff like Fox's The Simpsons, the syndicated Star Trek The Next Generation, HBO's Tales from the Crypt, and just about everything shown on PBS's American Playhouse. But even though I firmly believe that the quantity of options leads to a higher quality of TV, that theory doesn't always work out in practice. Take this week's telemovies, for example. On the major networks this weekend, we have one high-quality telemovie, ABC's Our Sons, which stars Anne Margaret and Julie Andrews in a story about two women whose sons have AIDS. But we also have a Fatal Attraction ripoff movie on CBS and a Knight Rider 2000 movie on NBC, which to me is more of a threat than an event. But the question is, are the non-network alternatives any better? Not necessarily. One miniseries popping up in syndication this month, called Vendetta, stars supermodel Carol Alt as a mafia bride. Pick a scene, any scene, and it's easy to conclude that this supermodel is no super actress.
You still don't want me?
Nancy, please don't.
Yes or no?
There is more to this than a yes or a no.
Not for me, there's not. Why are you playing this game? Tell me, Sean, do you want me, yes or no?
The answer is no. Then there's Red Wind, this week's made-for-cable telemovie on the USA Network. Lisa Hartman stars as a psychologist whose new patient is into masochism. Then again, so is Hartman's character. And for that matter, so is anyone who chooses to watch. Listen to the stiffness of this typical therapy session.
I use games a great deal in my work, and I'd like to try that with your husband.
But he's not here.
Well, in this game, I'd like for you to be your husband, and I'll play you. I'll start with a question, and you answer me honestly as he would, and we'll just see what happens, okay? What am I doing wrong, Mike?
Come over here.
I'm afraid of you.
Good.
Are you going to hurt me?
That's what you want, isn't it?
No, I want you to be nice to me.
Then take off your clothes.
What are you doing to me?
Put your hands over your head. Close your eyes.
I want you to stop it.
No, you don't. You don't want me to stop.
Well, I do. And next Monday on the Fox Network, there's a telemovie sequel that picks up where three awful theatrical movies left off. Yes, it's Omen 4, The Awakening. And do you really have to hear a clip from it to know that it's a bad omen? I don't think so. But it isn't all bleak out there. If you can, catch this month's Kurt Vonnegut's Monkey House on the Showtime cable network. It's a telemovie pilot for a proposed anthology series. And if it goes to series, and if later episodes are as good as the three shown in the pilot, Showtime will have itself the best anthology show since The Twilight Zone. For some of this other stuff, though, the best advice is to zone out.
David Bianculli is TV critic for The New York Post. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Sherrock, and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the obsessive world of bodybuilding. Sam Fussell was a skinny bookworm when he started pumping iron. He took it to the limit and gave it up when he became horrified at what he was turning himself into. That and more on the next Fresh Air.